When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And tonight I'm going to talk a little bit about approaches to looking at the empire building of Nazi Germany, Fascist Italy, and Imperial Japan, and the relationship between the economic crisis of the Great Depression and the desire for expansionism. And this kind of deep-seated resentment of these three kind of later imperial powers at the ability of Great Britain and to some lesser degree France to become kind of global powers as a result of kind of imperial acquisition. So we're looking again at the brilliant book Blood and Ruins by Richard Overy, which is a fantastic kind of treatise on a period he calls the Great Imperial War, which he says ran from 1931 to 45. Okay, so he begins by talking about the Manchurian Railway incident in 1931, which was the pretext for the Japanese invasion of Manchuria. In the Asahi newspaper in Osaka, the headline was, "In an act of outrageous violence, Chinese soldiers blew up a section of the Mantetsu track located in northwest of the Betiang military base and attacked our railway guards. Our guards immediately returned fire and mobilized the artillery to shell Betiang. Our forces are now in occupation of occupy a section of the base." Richard Overy writes, "This front page article in the popular daily newspaper Asahi presented the Japanese public with an account of Chinese perfidy that became embedded in Japanese popular perception of who was to blame for the onset of the subsequent Japanese invasion and occupation of the whole of the northern Chinese province of Manchuria. It was a travesty of the truth. A group of Japanese engineers from the Kwantung Army, stationed in Manchuria to protect the empire's economic interests in the region, planted explosives early on the morning of the 18th of September 1931 as a flimsy excuse to begin a program of military expansion into China that was not to end until 1945. It was a small incident in global terms, but its ramifications were much larger. It was the point in the depths of the world economic crisis when the first step was taken to create a new imperial and economic order by violence. The shots at the Beijing base signalled the onset of what was to become in the 1930s a new imperial age. So this is an important point. If we look at the succession of crises throughout the 1930s, beginning with Japan in Manchuria, and then the gradual dismemberment of the Treaty of Versailles by Hitler, Mussolini's invasion of Abyssinia in 1935, and the and then Japan's encroachment into China in 1937. What we can see is this attempt to solve the crises of the Great Depression using a manner that dictators understand: brute force and violence. Hitler, no economist, basically, his view on how one grows an economy is through conquest. Economic problems can be withstood by the general populace for a period of time, and eventually you grow your economy by seizing another resources of another ethnic group, an inferior one in the eyes of Hitler. Thus, you're really fulfilling nature's destiny that the strong shall oppress the weak. The circumstances of what the Japanese government came to term as the Manchurian incident were shaped by the wider global crisis and the desperate efforts in Japan to find some solution to the mounting poverty and economic isolation. The Kwantung Army, which took its name from the Japanese concession on the Chinese Manchurian coast, known as the Kwantung Leased Territory, had been plotting for some years to extend the Japanese Empire into mainland China. The Kwantung Army operated quite as a law unto itself. It was situated, obviously, a long way from the Japanese home islands, and was able to take autonomous decisions based around a racist expansionist ideology that was not always shared by Japan's civilian government. But as we've looked at previously, when for example Prince Konoye becomes the Japanese Prime Minister, he has a great deal of sympathy for their goals. Provoked by the scale of economic crisis, writes Richard Overy, and mindful of the persistent threat of Chinese nationalism, the army commanders finally decided to act independently of Tokyo. After Japanese soldiers had themselves blown up the short section of the Japanese-owned South Manchurian Railway, they stormed the local Chinese garrison at the port of Mukden. They captured the rest of the town and, in a carefully planned assault, fanned out from the leased territory, first seizing the areas around the main railway network and then driving 330,000 ill-equipped forces of the local Chinese warlord Zhang Ruiliang out of southern and central regions of Manchuria, completing the occupation of the province by early 1932. The army deployed 150,000 men and, for the loss of around 3,000 dead, conquered an area almost the size of Europe. Despite the flagrant breach of discipline, the Japanese Showa Emperor Hirohito approved the action 2 days later. Almost overnight, the Japanese Empire was transformed in size and wealth. So, in the view of the Kwantung Army, they had solved Japan's main problem, the intense poverty that parts of Japan suffered as a result of the Great Depression, by rapid, ruthless expansionism, facilitated by racial ideas of superiority over the Chinese. It is interesting to see how Emperor Hirohito, initially unaware of the plans, then uncertain about them, when presented with the success of them, almost falls behind the army and gives it his blessing. And when you look at the kind of the relationship between the army and the emperor throughout the war, so much so that at the end of the war, some of the army officers stage a coup to try to liberate the emperor from his decision to declare that the war is over and seek a peace with America. So there's some very complicated power dynamics there, and a certain sense of Japanese militarism providing the sorts of solutions that I suppose Japanese militarists believed that they had provided since the Meiji Restoration. The Manchuria incident did not directly cause the world war that broke out 8 years later, but it did inaugurate a decade of renewed imperial expansion to follow on from the new imperialism of the pre-1914 world and the imperial settlement at the end of the Great War. So it, again, Richard Overy refers to this period of in the 1880s and the 1890s, the kind of the scramble for Africa and this less well-defined scramble for China. And also the other key moment of imperial expansion by Britain and France, the outcome of the Paris Peace Conference, where the British Empire is at its largest size in 1919, when territories such as Mesopotamia and Transjordan and Palestine and parts of East Africa are handed over to Great Britain, and France has this kind of increase as well. The Italians are suitably kind of resentful and angry seeing the spoils that Great Britain has eyed up. So the three states that eventually defined the new imperialism, Italy, Germany and Japan, began with a definite plan or blueprint for expansion, but each acted opportunistically in established spheres of interest, nor did they concert their imperialism, though they observed each other's achievements closely and drew courage from each other's successes, even though leaders in all three states hoped that a more general war might be avoided for the moment while their imperial projects were completed. The instabilities provoked by these three separate programs fueled the drive to global war that opened up between 1939 and 41. One of the great questions that is posed about the Axis powers in the Second World War is precisely why they did not coordinate their imperial projects. Perhaps it is because the very nature of the nationalist and xenophobic and fascistic expansion of territory meant that they were adhering to very particular national narratives. Hitler had no interest in exploring, conversing with Japan or Italy when he eyed the carve-up of Poland. In fact, the conversations that he has are with Stalin. The idea, you know, that he has very specific ideas about Poland, that this is a country that has no right to exist, that its peoples are essentially squatting on German land and it's an invented country. It's interesting how many of the narratives about Ukraine that are circulating on the far right at the moment, between American American Fox News presenters and Putin loyalists, say essentially the same thing about Ukraine: it is a made-up country that has no intrinsic right to exist. Of course, that's not true. The disconnect between Germany and Japan and Italy meant that not only was imperial expansion not coordinated, but obviously war aims during the actual conflict aren't coordinated either in any meaningful way. There's no kind of equivalent of the Allied wartime conferences. So Richard Overy writes, the critical factor for Japan, Italy and Germany was territory. control of a territory, exercised in a variety of formal and informal ways, lay at the heart of empire. The model of this principle of territoriality was the 40 years of violent territorial expansion and pacification that preceded the 1930s and was in some cases still going on. Indeed, it was only in this longer context that the decisions taken in Rome, Tokyo or Berlin to wage local wars of aggression make historical sense.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
The discourses of race and space that had supported empire since the late 19th century had lost none of their explanatory force for the generation that came to power in the 1930s. Through this form of imperialism appears in retrospect anachronistic, even delusional, the paradigm of empire at the time seemed familiar and near. It's no secret that Hitler looked to other empires for his inspiration. He saw British control of India and the American annihilation of the Great Plains Indians as an example of, firstly, how a small group of settlers can control a large population, and also justification for the removals of inferior peoples and the exploitation of the land that they once inhabited. The reason for Japan's modernization was, from the 1860s onwards, a reaction to European imperialism in Asia. But the belief that Japan could lead a federation of Asian states towards emancipation, this was the more liberal end of Japanese modernization politics in the 19th and 20th centuries. This was supplanted by more nationalistic and xenophobic and racially racial superiority ideas in Japan by the early 20th century, suggesting that Japan was not there to lead a federation of equals, but was there to imperially conquer Asia in a far more all-encompassing way than the British and the French and the Dutch had ever achieved, and that this would be, and that Japan would become master of Asia and would be able then to kind of pivot world history eastwards and lead Asia and colonize everywhere from China to Indochina and Burma all the way to the Pacific. Richard Overy writes, "The results of the redistribution of territory in 1919-23, really the Treaty of Versailles and the subsequent treaties of Sevres and Lausanne, or the consequences of the economic catastrophe after 1929, and Treaty of Trianon, of course, only served to strengthen rather than weaken the belief that the seizure of more territory and resources was an indispensable means to save the nation, build a stronger economy, and satisfy the needs of a superior culture. So it, for in all three countries, the ideas around natalism, growing populations, and expanding peoples, around having a kind of like a vital and martial people who were hungry for more and couldn't be contained in their own behind their own borders, and needed the right to expand and to seize more territory. This becomes the argument here becomes, you know, if we don't do this, then the people themselves are done for. That we need to, in order to preserve the race, we need to grow. And these were ideas that were not exclusive to fascists. These were ideas, the sort of kind of social Darwinist and eugenicist ideas were largely accepted and popular in all sorts of seemingly liberal non-fascist societies. Countries like Britain and France and America that had all been the beneficiaries of colonialism. There were members of the intelligentsia and the political class and, you know, ordinary citizens who looked at these sorts of ideas and said, well, these are self-evidently true. And so this is why that, you know, for a great many people in the Western world, much of Hitler's rhetoric before the Second World War seems to be not entirely unreasonable. And the idea that the country, Germany, had been particularly badly treated and badly penalised and was allowed a chance to reclaim what was rightfully belonged to it. Japanese, Italian and German leaders were by no means the only ones to believe that the era of empire was not yet over, despite all the evidence that nationalist ambitions, rising economic costs and persistent insecurity marked the gradual decay of the global imperial project. Rather than drawing the obvious lesson that traditional imperialism was a fading enterprise, they argued that what they needed was more of it, marked with their own particular character. The other factors usually emphasised in analysing the origins of the Second World War, arms races, diplomatic crises, ideological conflict, were effects of a new wave of empire building, not causes. The major states in the League of Nations might, perhaps with reluctance, have lived with the ideological difference or increases in military spending if that was all that was dividing them. The factor that the major imperial states like France and Britain could not accept was the new wave of empire building in its raw territorial sense was now incompatible with their own view of empire and the new language of internationalism they had woven around it. So after the First World War, after the Treaty of Versailles and after the Paris Peace Conference and the Treaty of Versailles, the establishment of the League of Nations and the mandate system and the other systems of kind of rules-based international relations were very, very helpful to the British and the French, not so much America, as America had wasn't particularly an isolationist country, contrary to popular belief, but had become a unilateralist in world affairs, as opposed to engaging in multilateral organisations. And it was specialised in the 1920s of creating bilateral treaties that benefited America by and large. But the British and the French were not part of a benign world order dedicated to peace. They saw opportunities in the League of Nations to benefit and stabilise their empires, which had come under immense strain as a result of the First World War and now faced the challenges of nationalism in Africa and Asia and the Middle East. And so the problem for the British and the French when they saw challenges such as Mussolini's invasion of Abyssinia was how to contain a new and aggressive sort of imperialism. As Richard Overy points out, the domestic elites in Britain and France could have lived with Nazism, and they could have lived with Italian fascism and Japanese imperialism, as long as their own empires didn't come under threat. The great turning point amongst the British ruling classes, away from potential fascist sympathies. Hitler was, of course, looking to deal with the organised left and the socialist and communist parties that Europe and indeed Britain's ruling classes feared and despised. So he had advantages there. The moment that he falls out of favour is when he presents a threat to the British Empire, and when a new, more aggressive wave of imperialism threatens British and French imperial possessions around the world. France is always a slightly different case, because France eyed Germany with immense suspicion and caution as a result of the experience of two invasions from 1870 onwards, and so French security was a far greater part of France's concerns. And British security finally becomes an issue after sort of 1935, 1936, when it suddenly becomes abundantly clear that the next war will be fought from the air against highly populated cities. Anyway, I'm going to look more over a long, long period of time at Blood and Ruins. It's an amazing book. I do urge you all to get it. And in the meantime, you can come and find me at www.explaininghistory.org, and you can find us at the Explaining History Facebook group. And there's a whole bunch of other stuff as well, but those are the main portals. And we always accept kindly donations on Patreon, so if you can sponsor the podcast and keep us going, that's grand. Thanks very much, all the best, and I'll catch you on the next episode, when we're going to talk about Ireland, as I keep promising. All the best, bye bye. One that's mirrored in the huge problems in the US healthcare sector, and the difficulty that the seemingly intractable problem of attempts to create a free at the point of use healthcare service, which most of the modern countries in some way, shape or form enjoy. The implications for the rest of the world, as I said, are stark. The organisations and wealthy backers who have managed to overturn Roe versus Wade will now be immensely emboldened. Perhaps they won't succeed in Europe, but they will try. You know, of that you must be absolutely certain. And wherever you are, if you're not in the US, watch the media that you consume and look for the messages that will no doubt be kind of dropped into newspaper columns and leaders and here and in op-eds in TV, on TV shows and radio and podcasts, because there will be an attempt to make the argument first for the curbing and reduction of abortion rights, and then perhaps an outright ban similar to Roe versus Wade. These things often tend to follow. And also, this might be a huge and important moment for the women's movement inside America and beyond. It's difficult to say at the moment. There has been doesn't seem to have been the kind of spontaneous mass organising that happened when Trump was first elected in 2016. But give it time. give it time. It's only been a day or two, and no doubt there is a flurry of activity amongst the women's movements in America to organise some form of resistance. Okay, well, listen, I'm going to leave the update there. We're going to be coming back to that hopefully later in the week. Apologies, I've done fewer updates this week because, again, I've been suffering from long COVID and it's been kind of tiring. But, you know, I'll get over that. Thanks very much, everybody. I hope you find this useful, and we'll be getting back to some regular history in a moment. All the best. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.